This podcast features graphic details of real events taken from letters written by inmates convicted of murder. Listener discretion is advised.
When I was sentenced to death, I felt nothing. I knew I was going to be sentenced to death. I actually knew way before that, before my actual crime. I knew I was coming to death row. I knew we would get caught.
These are the written words of Nebraska inmate number 59147, Jose Sandoval. They're taken from a letter that he wrote to us in 2019.
I armed the gun and pointed the gun at the customer's head while she cringed. And I let a bullet loose.
My name is Zoe Hines. And Jose Sandoval is one of over 2,000 inmates that my colleague Ned Parker and I have corresponded with in our work as documentary filmmakers on television series including Netflix's I'm a Killer, A Killer Uncaged, The Murderer and Me, and Living with a Serial Killer.
And in this podcast, we're going to be exploring letters like these. Letters from convicted murderers across the United States. Letters that Zoe, myself, and our team have been receiving and reading for the past 5 years. As we search for stories to tell.
Fayetteville 911.
This is Letters from a Killer, a Podimo podcast. Episode 1, Merciful Murderer.
Our letter writer for this first episode is Jose Sandoval, who's currently on death row in Nebraska. Ned, what is it about Sandoval's letters that make him the perfect place to start this series?
He's very engaging as a writer, and he's very descriptive of the events that got him sent to death row, which reveals a lot about how he wants to portray himself to us.
I wanted to kill as little as possible, and I wanted to shoot them all in the head, because that was the quickest and fastest way to die.
A theme that I really want to explore in this episode is how Sandoval perhaps frames himself as, quote-unquote, a merciful murderer. He seems to attempt to do this by appealing to our sympathy in his letters. And as you'll hear from his writing, he also claims to reveal the real reason that he ended up on death row.
Before we dive into Sandoval's version of events, let's hear the details of what's been labelled by the press as the deadliest bank robbery attempt in the history of the state of Nebraska.
Letters from a Killer. Case file. The following details are taken from official news reports, court documents, and CCTV footage recorded from inside the bank itself. September 2002, 8:45 a.m. Jose Sandoval approaches a bank in the town of Norfolk, Nebraska. He is intending to commit armed robbery along with four other men. Once inside the bank, CCTV cameras record every moment. The men disperse. One turns towards the office of staff member Lola Elwood. Another towards the office of employee Lisa Bryant. Jose Sandoval approaches the bank's front counter, where bank teller Sam's son is serving a customer, Yvonne Tuttle. From the bank's drive-in window, a customer sees Sandoval wave employee Joe Mousbach over to join Sun and Tuttle at the counter. Sandoval then shoots Mousbach and Sun, followed by the counter customer, Yvonne Tuttle. From her car, the drive-in customer makes the first 911 call. Seconds later, Sandoval's accomplices shoot the staff members Lola Elwood and Lisa Bryant. Another customer enters the bank, but flees when shot at and makes the second 911 call. In under 60 seconds, five people were shot and killed. When Sandoval and his cohorts exited the bank, they left without a single dollar.
Straight away, this is a case where you immediately want to know more. It's a brutal and lethal crime that's resulted in a number of people dead, and yet the apparent motivation was simply a robbery in order to steal money, but they end up walking away with nothing.
So before we've even written to Sandoval, we've got questions to ask him. We want to know why commit that crime if not for the money. Had they planned to kill people? Was this just senseless violence? How is he going to respond to these questions?
The voice you're about to hear is not Jose Sandoval himself, it's the voice of an actor. But these are very much Sandoval's words, as he wrote them to us from death row.
It was my idea that we needed at least four people to pull this off. Three inside the bank, and one outside as the getaway driver and the lookout through walkie-talkie. We were already together as one group, small, but strong and tight, ready to take on anyone.
These are the events of the bank robbery, as told by Sandoval himself in graphic detail.
I actually prayed to God.
I hope there ain't many people in there, because I don't want to kill a lot of innocent people.
We entered, and each of us went to our designated areas. We had agreed that I would go to the front, while one went to the left and the other to the right. I saw that there were three people at the front. One was a customer, and two were working the counter, like I expected. I went up to the customer, put my gun to her head, and pulled the trigger. But nothing happened. Then I looked at the gun as if something was wrong with it. It hit me that the safety was on. I armed the gun and pointed the gun at the customer's head while she cringed and had her hands to her head. And I let a bullet loose. It hit her in the head. I went up to the counter and pointed the gun at both of them and said,
"Give me the money."
They just stood there in shock. I was wondering, why were they just looking at me, as if they were deer in headlights? I got mad and said again to give me the money, but they just stood there, shocked. You must know that the plan was to go in there and kill everyone, leave no witnesses. But I wasn't going to kill the employees, just yet. I needed the money first. But I had to let them know that I was serious, and I had planned to shoot up in the air to get their attention, in hopes to get them to move faster, because I knew we didn't have much time. But I improvised and shot the customer to get their attention.
Having detailed the brutal execution of an innocent bystander, Sandoval then attempts to appeal to our empathy and begins to try to paint himself as somehow merciful.
I wanted to kill as little as possible, and I wanted to shoot them all in the head, because that was the quickest and fastest way to die. I didn't want them to suffer, so I told the homies to aim for the head.
Let's pause hearing from Sandoval's letters for just a moment and draw attention to the apparent contradiction here. Having previously said that their plan was to go in and kill everyone during this robbery, Sandoval is now saying that he wanted to kill as little as possible.
It's contradictory, and it's something that we would definitely want to ask about if we were to turn this into a documentary. Why is he writing that? What's he trying to suggest about himself in those lines? Does he really think that this somehow demonstrates his humanity?
Let's go back to Sandoval's letters, where he continues his very unsettling account of the bank robbery. And let's hear what happens next.
I wasn't a Christian then, though I believed that there was a God, and I believed in Jesus, but never followed him. That is one thing that pops out to me, that I actually prayed to God that there wouldn't be a lot of people in there. So after shooting the customer in the head, I pointed my gun at the two tellers, and they were stunned. And my anger burned. So I shot the female in the face, and then pointed my gun at the Asian man and shot him in the head too. I then lost my mind for a quick second and yelled at them for not giving me the money. I jumped the counter and tried to open the register, but couldn't. And then I heard the gurgling of suffering. I turned and saw the Asian man choking on his blood. So I pointed the gun at him, downward, and shot him another time. He stopped gurgling. I looked at the customer lying in a pool of her own blood. I looked at my gun and thought to myself,
how easy it is to kill someone with a gun. It don't take much in a way. It ain't fair.
Unlike a lot of the people that we hear from in these letters who claim that they didn't intend to take anyone's life, Sandoval is really explicit that they went in there with the intention of killing everyone. And I think immediately here of those victims who were Sam's son, Joe Mausbach, Yvonne Tuttle, Lola Elwood, and Lisa Bryant. Five people who lost their lives within 60 seconds and for no apparent reason at all.
It's all over so fast, and yet he has managed to tell quite a story.
This happens a lot with the convicted killers who've written to us. They do tell a story. This is their story. It is about them. And of course, they are the central figure. But for me, Sandoval does this on a different level. I mean, doesn't he?
Absolutely. He's the hero in his own version of the story, for sure.
It's almost as if he's writing a film script in his letter to us. And this is my personal opinion, but it feels like he's enjoying the retelling of these events. And it almost feels as if he's enjoying placing himself in that position, as if this is a film, a kind of a Tarantino film, where he's the hero, or the anti-hero at least, the lead protagonist, certainly, in this filmed story of his life.
It's the decorative nature of the phrases that I really, really struggle to hear. The gurgling of suffering is almost poetic in the way that he's constructed it. And to me, that says that he's thinking of this not as a recollection of what actually happened, but as some kind of dramatisation.
Now, that could just be brutal honesty. It could, of course, be because he's accepted what he's done is wrong, but it could also be bragging that's leading him to writing in this way. It doesn't feel like he's just relating the facts. But looking at it from another perspective, when you write to someone who is a convicted killer, who admits that they are a murderer, what do you hope to receive back? As documentary makers, what we hope to receive is openness and honesty so that we can discuss it and hopefully learn more. But revisiting these letters, I'm taken right back to 2019, when we first received them. And the impact that they had on me at the time was that I couldn't help but just turn the page and read on.
This is Letters from a Killer, a Podimo podcast.
This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp. They're an online counselling service that will assess your personal needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist.
BetterHelp isn't a crisis line or self-help. It's professional counselling done securely online.
BetterHelp is available to all our listeners wherever you are in the world, and you can start communicating with a licensed professional therapist in under 48 hours.
You can log into your account at betterhelp.com anytime and send a message to your counsellor. You'll get timely and thoughtful responses. Plus, you can schedule weekly video or phone sessions.
BetterHelp is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches, so they make it easy and free to change counsellors if needed. And it's more affordable than traditional offline counselling. Financial aid is also available.
BetterHelp wants you to start living a happier life today. Visit their website and read the testimonials that are posted there. Here's a couple. I never had therapy before, but BetterHelp made me feel extremely comfortable and safe when discussing my feelings. Also, I approached this method of counselling with an open mind, not knowing what to expect. I've been extremely impressed with my counsellor. She has a genuine interest in my overall health and healing process.
Visit betterhelp.com to read more and join over a million people who've taken charge of their mental health with the help of an experienced professional.
This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp, and listeners to Letters from a Killer will get 10% off their first month when they visit betterhelp.com/LFAK.
Let's hear another extract from Jose Sandoval's letters. Here he explains to us what he claims is the real reason for ending up on death row.
I knew I was guilty, and I knew I deserved it. But my attorneys had to do their job. It was pointless, because they never knew what I know now. I know now why I'm on death row. Pay close attention, because here's the real reason. I'm not here because of greed or because I wanted money. I'm not here because I murdered a lot of people. And yet I am here because of those physical sins. I'm here because of a girl. She broke my heart and cheated on me. And a part of me died inside.
Jose Sandoval has now presented different versions of himself. So who is he? Is he the Bonnie and Clyde gun-killing robber, or is he the heartbroken individual? How do you get to the truth of it?
My absolute first move would be to try and find the girlfriend. He's volunteered a third party into this narrative, who he is now suggesting, however indirectly, somehow instigated the pain that led to that horrific crime. Most of us have been through heartbreak. I don't think any of us would take responsibility for our ex-partner's subsequent actions. And I would imagine that person has some pretty interesting thoughts on the reality of their relationship, but also on Sandoval's self-characterization. So what have we learned so far? Sandoval is clearly painting himself as a certain kind of lead protagonist in the retelling of his own life story. He's explained to us in his letters that he didn't want his victims to suffer, so he assassinated them quickly with a shot to the head. He's trying to paint these actions as somehow merciful.
But in his next letter, he begins to reveal how he came to terms with his violent actions. While in prison, he would have a lot of time to reflect on the violence of his murders, and while on death row, he claims that he embraced his faith and that he fully converted to Christianity.
I told myself, and God,
I take full responsibility for my actions, and if it is your will that I die, then so be it.
I'm not running from it. I don't want to die, but I ain't running from my punishment.
If you want to save me, then you do it. But it won't come from me, Father.
I won't fight it no more, and I won't go looking for an attorney either.
If an attorney comes to me, then I'll know that you sent them.
I knew that God had my back. I have a saying that you'll hear me say a lot.
Everything happens for a reason, and there is a purpose to everything.
Jose Sandoval is now talking explicitly about his religious conversion, which is something we see fairly regularly, Ned.
Yeah, we do. It's not necessarily surprising that people who are on death row or going to spend the rest of their life in prison might claim to have found faith, but they do tend to have found a particular God. It's not just any religion, it generally tends to be a Christian God, and it tends to be a fairly American Baptist version of that Christian God. So that's not hugely surprising. But the phrase that Sandoval says here, everything happens for a reason and there is a purpose to everything. Just on a personal level, after reading lots of these letters, it's a phrase I've heard a number of times and it's one which I've grown to dislike personally. Because it kind of encourages this fatalistic idea of, you know, if everything happens for a reason, you're justified in whatever you want it to justify. And I find that a hard one to kind of square off when I read these letters, because to me, it absolves anybody of taking responsibility for anything. And this ties into this kind of idea of him finding his religion. Now, the US prison system, I think, is about trying to reform people, at least notionally it is, and is about rehabilitation. And of course, that also happens to be the central tenet of the Christian faith, as well as forgiveness and of love and repentant sinners. So I can obviously understand why inmates particularly will turn to Christianity, but it's not a surprise that this was going to come with Sandoval in his letters from the way that he was writing to us.
Before we perhaps look at why he might be using faith and Christianity in this context, we should point out that we do get inmates who have gone through a process of genuine reform and found God.
A staggeringly high percentage of the people who write to us say that they have found God. And openly and initially, of course, I say that's great. If someone has found faith and that faith provides them with comfort. It provides them with a way to reflect on the terrible things that they've done and try and improve and to be a better person, then that is great. Obviously, there is a certain amount of skepticism with at least some of those. My personal opinion has been that with some individuals, it doesn't feel totally genuine. Now, from what he's written to us, Sandoval, we would want to hear more of his story. We'd want to hear more from the people who knew him as well. But at this stage, it is feeling very convenient. For certain inmates, the sense of Christian forgiveness is that they feel that this is a forgiveness that should be applied to them. And that's the feeling that I'm getting here from Sandoval. Everything happens for a reason. There is a purpose to everything. He's saying, it wasn't my fault. I'm a Christian, and therefore people should treat me as a Christian, and Christians get forgiven. So it's kind of in that sense that it's feeling extraordinarily kind of convenient to have found this faith. Now, we were looking at Jose Sandoval's story as a possible case for the Netflix series I'm a Killer. Thinking back over those 20, 21 different cases that we've covered in the series, not only have a disproportionately high number of the inmates subsequently found religion or Christianity, but I'd say a disproportionately high number of the victims have also been practicing Christians.
I think when something like this happens in your life, whether you were the victim of it or the perpetrator, it makes you ask the big questions, the existential questions. You start thinking about what's good and what's bad, life and death, and spirituality is a place where you can start to have those conversations. In Sandoval's letter, he seems to be seeking redemption for his actions. He explains that he found God 4 years after the events of the bank robbery, and that through embracing faith, he came to the conclusion that everything happens for a reason, and that God had his back. When he found God, perhaps he found the forgiveness that he was searching for. Let's hear what happened in the long and complex court proceedings that ran over many years after Sandoval's arrest.
Letters from a Killer. The Verdict. The following details are taken from official news reports and court documents. On November 24th, 2003, a jury convicted Jose Sandoval of 5 counts of first-degree murder and 5 counts of use of a deadly weapon. On December 2nd, 2003, the jury returned a further verdict, acknowledging several aggravators. These included the assertion that Sandoval's actions were particularly heinous, atrocious, and cruel, that he knowingly created a great risk of death to several persons, and that he displayed exceptional depravity. On January 14, 2005, Jose Sandoval was sentenced to the death penalty for each of the 5 counts of first-degree murder. Sandoval received 48 to 50 years imprisonment for 3 counts of use of a deadly weapon and 50 years imprisonment for 2 counts of use of a deadly weapon. Both sentences were to be served consecutively. Having been convicted for the bank robbery murders, he was also given a further 2 life sentences after confessing to a prior murder. Following Sandoval's confession, his accomplices were all given 2 life sentences each for their murders. Jose Sandoval awaits the death sentence in Nebraska State Penitentiary.
The Nebraska Department of Corrections wouldn't allow us access to interview Jose Sandoval, which is not uncommon. That happens a lot. But the part about him committing the crime in Nebraska is particularly interesting, because the death penalty isn't uniform across the US. Every state is somewhat different, and there are currently 28 states out of 50 that have the death penalty, even if it's not used in all of them. And there was no death penalty at all in the US for about 10 years until 1977 or thereabouts. But in Nebraska, the state legislature actually repealed the death sentence in 2015. So while Sandoval has been in prison, the death sentence was actually abandoned, but then it was reinstated the following year in 2016 after a general election.
So during this time, everybody who'd been on death row was taken off death row and was then put back on death row again.
Yeah, and there was a legal campaign, a legal challenge to say that these people who had been awarded life sentences in place of their death sentences shouldn't now be sent back to death row. I mean, how humane is that? I mean, there's obviously the debate about the morality of the death sentence in any case, but for someone not to be able to know whether they're going to live or die from one year to the next on the basis of a popular vote, a general election, which is what they did in 2016, to me that does just seem inordinately cruel. So what have we learnt in this first episode of Letters from a Killer?
Principally, the thing to take away from Sandoval's letters is that you don't necessarily come away from corresponding directly with an inmate feeling like you've absolutely securely understood the events that happened. These can be very contradictory accounts because these things are complicated.
Absolutely. People themselves are complicated. Violent crime is complicated. And the concepts of what constitutes true repentance, genuine regret, or just punishment, they are complex. For me, it's very hard to know who Sandoval is. He does seem to change how he's presenting himself from one letter to the next. One minute he's the lead role in a violent heist film.
You must know that the plan was to go in there and kill everyone. Leave no witnesses.
The next he's a merciful murderer.
I wanted to kill as little as possible. I didn't want them to suffer.
Or he's a jilted lover.
She broke my heart and cheated on me. And a part of me died inside.
Or he's a reformed Christian.
I knew that God had my back.
He claims to be all of these things.
I have a saying that you'll hear me say a lot.
Everything happens for a reason. And there is a purpose to everything.
While investigating the events surrounding stories such as Sandoval's, it's our responsibility as documentary filmmakers to be accurate in the portrayal that there's always more than one side. There's always more than one account. There's more than one perspective. And it's only through trying to reveal the complexities of the story that we might just get closer to understanding the truth.
But there's one thing in all of this that isn't a matter of perspective, interpretation, subjectivity. And that is that five people lost their lives in under 60 seconds on the day of this crime as a result of Jose Sandoval's actions.
Next time on Letters from a Killer. The Good Samaritan slaying.
The morning before the murder took place, my second oldest sister gave me a call, telling me she was on her way to visit my son and I. Upon her arrival, she noticed many bruises on my face and arms and mentioned to my sister how I wanted out of the lifestyle and abusive relationship I was in. When she left, I was devastated.
Letters from a Killer was hosted by Zoe Hines and Ned Parker and is a Podimo podcast by Transistor Films. Support the show by sharing on social media and following the podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts.